Welcome back to the Charlotte Angel Connection, the Charlotte area podcast linking entrepreneurs, investors, and the broader Charlotte community. As you know, our goal here is to interview the individuals who are building, shaping, and influencing entrepreneurship in the Charlotte region so you can stay invested in Charlotte's growth. Today, we are fortunate to have Lucas Timberlake, who is a partner with the FinTech Ventures Fund, join us. I met Lucas at the Southeast FinTech Venture Conference in November, the conference that kind of celebrated the end of QC FinTech Class 7. Lucas was up on the stage for an early panel as we talked about the various differences between angel investing, growth investing, and maybe later stage VC investing. And since we don't have a true venture fund here in Charlotte, I thought it'd be a great opportunity to just connect with Lucas, find out a little bit more about how he got to where he was, what his fund, you know, invest in, how it came about to be, how difficult it was to raise capital, and just kind of investing in general. I, you know, wanted to get his help in defining some kind of key areas for investors here in Charlotte, as we talked about a little bit before and after the podcast. Since kind of illiquid high growth investing isn't something we've seen a lot of here in Charlotte, there seems to be a little bit of a, or it seems to be the possibility for some gap in knowledge. So we try to fill that in a little bit today. We also, in this podcast, we talk a little bit about the Charlotte scene specifically, both from a startup, but also from an investor perspective. So, and that leads us into what you'll see where we're going to end up next week, which is a little bit more of a deep dive into some things that are going on in Charlotte that are positive and some things that we can continue to improve on. So really cool, nice interview with Lucas. And again, even though he's not here in Charlotte, I think, and as you'll hear, we'll see more and more of Lucas and his fund, and I think other venture funds here in the Charlotte area on a more frequent basis here over the course of 2018. So certainly hope you enjoyed today's podcast. So Lucas, thanks so much for taking some time to join us on the podcast today. To kind of get started, can you give us a little bit of a background on who you are and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. First off, thanks for having me and appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. So we started FinTech Ventures in 2015 and really saw a need for early stage FinTech venture capital to serve primarily the Southeast and really anywhere east of Silicon Valley. Yeah. And I started FinTech Ventures alongside my partner, Sergey Kuzmin, and we both came from private equity operating backgrounds, and he has had ties to Atlanta, and I've had ties to New York, and we decided that there's a great partnership to put together and to start looking at some of the seed to Series B, which is where we focus primarily FinTech funds across lending, payments, and InsurTech, with a specific focus on anyone that is considered unbanked or underbanked, which is about, call it 25% of the U.S. population. And so we really focus on becoming the first level of institutional capital. Our check sizes are 1 to 10 and probably do 2.5 to 3 million on average. So we are not doing pre-seed companies or pre-revenue companies. We're really focusing on companies after they've developed an MVP and are ready to go to market and scale with our guidance and assistance.
Gosh knows, you mentioned a bunch of different things there, and I'm a process them at different rates. So how did you get into venture then? So what brought you to it? Obviously, you've got a background in New York. Your partner's got a background in Atlanta. But how does somebody end up in venture, or somebody like you end up in venture, Lucas?
Sure. So I took a rather circuitous route, I guess you could say, and started in investment banking at a large investment bank in New York. And then, having done several years there, went to join a middle market private equity firm where we were actually buying parking companies primarily. And then we started to put in payments technology to make them more efficient. And that's how I got interested in the whole payments realm, which is one of the areas of focus of our FinTech fund. And I was actually coming down to Atlanta to visit one of the companies that we had and learned about my current partner now. And we got to talking, and it was the right time to launch this fund. So some people, in terms of doing venture, have founded a company and exited it and gone into venture that way. I kind of took a different path, but kind of what I like about venture capital is none of the VCs that I meet, they have typical kind of stories that got them into the system here. It's kind of being the right place in the right time and having the right mindset regarding it. It's a lot different than any other types of investing that you do, but that's kind of what I like about it at the same time.
Yeah, no, definitely. So you mentioned you raised a $100 million fund in 2015. How difficult is it to raise a $100 million fund? I mean, it's probably easier in 2015 than it was in 2009, but how difficult is it?
Sure. So luckily, my partner had the existing relationships, so the fundraising was relatively minimal. But I will say it's a very difficult process. On average, you should probably expect to take anywhere from 12 to 18 months. And I would say the other piece of advice I would give to someone that is looking to do so is you should always be fundraising, even if you don't have an active fund to fundraise, in terms of if you're already deploying capital from a current fund, never turn down a meeting from an investor, because you never know, A, how long that relationship takes to build, and B, you never know when you'll probably need to come back and recircle that kind of relationship. So you should always be fundraising, even if you're not actively fundraising, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So you mentioned too that your average deal size is probably 1.5 to 3 million. So you've got a $100 million fund. How many companies do you expect that? I mean, you can do the quick math, right? But that doesn't necessarily always turn out to be the case. I mean, you'd look at somewhere between 30 and 40 companies if that was the case. Will y'all invest in 30 or 40 million companies, or are y'all going to hold back a fair amount for add-ons and other needs as it goes along?
Yeah, so I think there's two ways that I would approach that. I'd say first off, being the first time fund and having flexible LPs, we're relatively flexible on how we're going to end up deploying this capital. But yes, a lot of it is reserved for follow-ons, and that's because you're just essentially waiting for the companies to be de-risked. So let's say you invest several million and they hit their milestones, you would like that opportunity to invest alongside a later stage investor, because you've essentially kind of de-risked the thesis there. So you do reserve a great deal of the capital for follow-ons. Second, we just realized within fintech, generally speaking, it's probably going to be very difficult to deploy that full amount. So we're still in the process of deploying it, but trying to figure out how much we cap the fund at currently is something that we're still looking to decide at this current moment. So it may not be the full 100 million. It's just mainly a bandwidth issue in terms of finding enough companies. You probably have to go through a very large universe to fill that fund. So in essence, it's going to be kind of TBD in terms of how much we fully deploy of that.
Fair enough. So we were talking a little bit beforehand, before we started this podcast, about the Charlotte market still kind of coming on board and aspects of, and certainly venture being outside the scope of what regular Charlatans talk about on an everyday basis. And in your kind of intro, you mentioned the fact that it's a growth stage fund and y'all typically invest up through Series B. Can you talk a little bit more about what that means so that the everyday listener can kind of catch on to what y'all are doing as a fund company?
Sure. So typically, I would say there's probably kind of three main stages of venture investing. And it starts off with people called angel investors that are usually high net worth individuals that are investing in pretty much ideas in terms of it's a founder, two founders, and a business plan. And, you know, they're doing checks from anywhere from 5 to 10,000, you know, up to several hundred thousand, if not more. And that's really to get the company off the ground. And there's the most degree of risk, obviously, there, because most of the companies haven't even generated a cent of revenue or don't have an MVP, which is a what we call a minimally viable product that's ready to go to market. And so that's kind of the first stage. And we don't participate there. We kind of like to have a little bit more value and kind of follow on after the angels. So we started something called the seed stage, which is basically kind of usually the company's first VC round of capital after they've been able to raise angel capital to prove out the model. And we'll go anywhere up to kind of Series B. And Series A obviously comes after the seed, and that's usually a larger round than the seed. I hate to put kind of number ranges because it really depends on the company, but you know, you could say your seed is anywhere from 500 to 750, which is kind of typical for what I've seen, to, you know, 2 million. And then, you know, your Series A, which is once you've kind of de-risk the seed, can be anywhere from, you know, 2 to 10, and some companies raise more. And then there's a significant degree of risk if a company can, you know, use that capital efficiently and go on to the B round. Usually it's what you call growth equity investors that write larger checks than we typically do, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20 million, but they also like to see revenues and clear paths to profitability. And, you know, usually they'll have a threshold of a few million in ARR, annual recurring revenue, that these growth and equity investors will require. So we do go up to Series B, but really the majority of our investments have been kind of seed to Series A and being the first institutional level of capital coming in, because that's where we've found the most value.
No, it makes a ton of sense. So I can't remember if it's on the website or if it's on your LinkedIn profile that you mentioned you like to have an active role within the companies. What is an active? Did I read that right, Lucas?
Yes. I mean, and that's a great question. I think my advice to any entrepreneur going to look for capital is to ask the question how the VC adds value, or why should I accept money from the VC is another good question. Because there's, you know, what you call kind of passive money and then what you call your active money. And I think most VCs would like, or most entrepreneurs, I should say, would like someone that's more active and that adds direct value as opposed to just cutting a check. So for us, it's really providing support in terms of we're operators kind of at heart and really like to get involved from providing support outside of just showing up to the board meetings, whether that's introductions to potential investors to the next round, or whether it's really providing strategic relationships or talent. It's really kind of adding value on a daily or weekly basis, as opposed to just in between quarterly board meetings. So that's really kind of how I see it. And it's also being able to provide some sort of industry expertise you can speak to directly to the companies. I think that's also very valuable, because a founder may have his head down under his desk and not necessarily be looking at the pulse of in the industry that he or she is operating in. And I think that's in important as well, because we see hundreds of companies kind of on a daily, monthly basis, and really being able to see common themes and relay them to your founders ahead of time, I think is a very important part of a VC as well.
No, it makes sense. So when we talk active, I mean, we're not talking about y'all aren't hopping in on a, you know, in a COO or CMO or CFO role. You're almost, for lack of a better term, you're almost kind of serving like a parent in helping guide, make connections, push them in this direction, pull them away from there, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a fair analogy, or am I off on that?
No, that's a fair analogy. You know, I would say that we would hop in at an operating level if we were required to. Luckily, none of the companies that we've had so far have had that opportunity, but you really have to be that jack of all trades. And yes, we'll get involved with the companies in terms of taking an interim role as necessary. So, but yes, I mean, it is essentially, you could call it being the parent of all these companies and really just making sure that they hit their metrics and maintain focus.
Fair enough. I guess for all intents and purposes, Britney Spears' parents had to jump in and help her out as an adult kid too, right? So we probably all need different levels of help from time to time.
Exactly. No, I mean, it really ebbs and flows. And I think that's the very interesting part of this business is you have a lot of troughs and peaks, and it's all about how you manage that. So, you know, at one point, probably 6 months ago, I thought I'd have to get involved with several companies more proactively. But now, you know, they've kind of righted the ship, and that's the fun, exciting, difficult, daunting part of this business is it's a little bit kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say difficult than other investment types in terms of private equity, growth equity, but it's definitely, you can kind of hit rock bottom pretty quickly, but you can also make some major breakthroughs very quickly as well. And it's just all about how you kind of manage those expectations and focus for your companies.
Yeah, I mean, extremely interesting to me, right? I mean, you're investing in early stage companies, so, you know, they're beyond idea stage, but I mean, it's not $100 million company. So they, for lack of a better term, they're always teetering on the edge. How do you make that determination? I've got to jump in versus I've got to sit back and kind of let this play out a little bit.
That's a great question. I would say the answer that's not 100% foolproof on this would be, you want to be actively involved and actively speaking in the management so you're able to kind of see the problems before they arise. And you're never always going to be able to do that, but it's very important to be in that position through active dialogues and developing good relationships with the founders. So even when things go wrong, you still have that kind of mutual trust and admiration for each other to be able to right the ship. But you know, I don't have necessarily a good answer in terms of, you know, how do you detect crisis or, you know, how do you jump in and how do you let things play out? But I'd say if you trust your founders, it makes it a lot easier to be able to add value as necessary kind of from oversight and not necessarily have to step in and right the ship yourself. So I think it's really just developing relationships, being proactive, maintaining open dialogues and having transparency, honestly, is very key to these types of, you know, situations and trying to avoid them.
Yeah, it's what makes it so difficult, right? I mean, it's almost the art aspect of it. Understanding the ebb and flow of one business is completely different from the ebb and flow of a different business.
Yeah, completely. So I think that makes sense. And so you also have to understand the industries and like I said, spend a lot of time talking to people and having your ear to the ground and understanding kind of macro issues that may affect your companies and being able to predict them or kind of understand why, you know, if a company isn't doing well, it could be something that's beyond both of your controls in terms of just something that's changing in an industry in terms of cyclical patterns or whatnot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So on that note, I mean, obviously, you know, anytime you look at a company, whether or not it's, you know, Apple or whether or not it's an idea, the team that's pushing it is important. Over the course of the last couple months, I've interviewed a couple of what I would call mature founders. So people that are probably in their late 40s and early 50s. And then obviously throughout my time on the podcast, I've had an opportunity to interview some of the younger folks, you know, those folks that are just fresh out of school. And the mature people have a certain bit of a head start because they've got contacts and relationships and know people, you know, from their previous roles. And the young people have a certain advantage. What do you look for in a management team?
Yeah, so for us, I will say that the majority of our founders are serial entrepreneurs, but that's not necessarily something we've looked at specifically for, if that makes sense. And especially within fintech, the founders tend to skew a little bit older, and it's partially because there's a lot of regulatory issues that need to be navigated. So a lot of them actually are former, you know, lawyers that dealt with some industry, saw a problem, and then went out to solve it using financial technology and building their own businesses. So I think for us, it's an understanding of the industry and direct related experience, even if it's not founding a company directly in it, is important. And the other thing too is, I think to see that they're coachable is important. You want them to have their own opinions, and you don't want them to accept your advice 100% of the time, but you want them to be open to it and be able to provide, you know, active counter arguments on why they think, you know, you're wrong as the VC, to kind of create a good trusting relationship. And so what I would say is really being able to accept constructive feedback, and even if you don't think it's correct, being able to articulately develop counter arguments, I think, is the greatest kind of intangible of a VC founder relationship. And that's what we really look for. There's no one specific trait besides, you know, genuine grit, which is a word that's being thrown around a lot now, you know, within the startup world, but I think it really applies. And, you know, you look at accelerators like Q City, and I don't think there's a real skew between maybe younger founders and older founders. Maybe there's some kind of more first-time founders, but if you look at it, they have a pretty diverse group of founders and have been able to prove out that model. So I don't think there's one, you know, trait, I would say, that we specifically look for.
Early on in the conversation, and I want to get back, and we'll probably tackle it in part two of the podcast, just the Charlotte scene and what's happening and maybe what's not happening here. But you mentioned that, you know, you were raising the fintech fund, or you raised the fintech fund, you know, primarily east of the valley, so everything excluding San Francisco. What's the difference between venture right now in San Francisco and venture in the rest of the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, a lot of people ask to the question, what does Charlotte or Atlanta or, you know, New York have to do to become the Valley, or, you know, kind of different iterations of that question. And, you know, first off, I'm glad you answered that question, because I didn't ask that specific question because I think it's not the question we should be asking, because they're different markets, and they should be, and they have their own strengths. But in terms of the differences, I mean, I'd say that there's more early stage capital out there. So that means that more early stage ideas get funded because there's more angel investors out there. And the reason being is because they've had more larger exits. And so the Southeast in general has had to play catch up, although there have been some earlier successes in terms of exits. Because what you really want to happen for any ecosystem is that you have founders that have exited their businesses successfully and then are willing to deploy the capital back into the ecosystem and fund early stage ideas and help nurture them. And so that's kind of what, you know, we need the Southeast to have more of. But luckily, I think that's slowly starting to change. And a company, for instance, Cardlytics, filed the other day for an IPO, and that's one of the big fintech success stories in Atlanta. So if we have kind of other stories like that that start to materialize, I think there'll be a greater deployment of early stage capital in terms of angel investors and things like that that come into the ecosystem and really help people build strong businesses within the Southeast. So I think those are kind of the major differences, is having more exits and more access to capital, not necessarily better ideas, that kind of separate the Valley and the rest of the country.
So good point. And one of the things we were talking about earlier was kind of institutional money versus quote unquote angel money, and how it takes, you know, it takes angels to get it to the point that instant is de-risked enough. That doesn't necessarily mean a lot on y'all's end, but most of the times it takes angels, whether it's a fund or a group of individuals that come together to support it, to get it up to the point where, you know, you and other venture funds like you would invest as well. I mean, there's a fair amount of money in the Southeast to be angel investors and to get it up to seed level, correct?
Yeah, I don't think it's an issue of necessarily the capital. I just think it's an issue of the investors that have money, whether they're high net worth individuals or corporations and things like that, investment funds, you name it. I think it's just a matter of getting them to understand how to invest in and nurture startups. So in the Valley, you have a lot of tech entrepreneurs, as I said, coming back in and investing, and they understand how to nurture businesses. And that's why the angel success rate has been pretty high. And then they have more companies, generally speaking, that get to the point that VCs will invest in them. And so I think it's really just changing kind of the mindset and, you know, developing greater awareness to do so that's been important. I mean, I think another trend that I've seen in Atlanta specifically is there's a lot of venture capital investors that have left larger funds and then created their own syndicates to go out and invest at the kind of pre-seed or seed stage. And they basically pool capital from high net worth investors that may not be able to do their own angel deals and structure them or look at them, but they can kind of create these micro funds that have, while it's early, it created a fair amount of success in my eyes. And I think that's, you know, a model is to be able to allow more people to participate. And, you know, crowdfunding, a lot of these other regulations, I think will also open up the doors to the average kind of investor that wants to start angel investing but doesn't necessarily know how to do that or how to provide the value to kind of nurture these companies past the investment once, you know, the time comes for them to start fundraising and also open up those doors, because that's also important as well, to fundraise for the next round. Just because you've cut the angel check doesn't mean your job's over.
Absolutely. So really, I've enjoyed the conversation so far. It's gone in two different directions I wasn't really expecting. And as we, you know, kind of up here on 25 or so minutes, which starts to wrap up our first podcast, I want to talk a little bit more about, as we wrap this one up and go into the next one, I want to talk a little bit more about kind of the Charlotte market from a startup and investor scene. And then I want to talk about what else goes into what y'all do, right? So you obviously cut checks, you help on the operational, or you're there on the operational side of things as well. But you mentioned making introductions to the next round. I'm curious if y'all are active and maybe helping from an acquisition strategy, if that's something that they're looking at that level. I guess to what you just said a couple of minutes ago, I want to explore some of that education component so that people know kind of what to expect in your end of the world. But I've enjoyed it up till now. I'm looking forward to part two. Anything else you want to add from just our conversation now, knowing kind of what I'm gearing to discuss in part two, Lucas?
No, I think this has been very, very productive.
Thanks for part one. Look forward to, you know, continuing the conversation next week.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Charlotte Angel Connection with Lucas Timberlake. Again, with the FinTech Ventures Fund out of Atlanta, Georgia. They've also got an office up in New York. You know, $100 million fund. They've been operating now for going on 3 years, 6 portfolio companies, nice little focus. I think it ties in nicely to what Dan and his team over at QC FinTech are doing. So I think we'll see some more of Lucas here in 2018 and 2019 and beyond. Nice little conversation there to wrap up the end of the first podcast. As you can tell, that's going to segue nicely into part two of our podcast with Lucas next week, where we're going to focus a little bit more on Charlotte as a capital scene and what's happening and what we can improve on. And then also wanted just to circle back in and focus a little bit more on Lucas's fund and what they're doing and how they're doing it. So hopefully enjoyed part one of the podcast with Lucas, but certainly look forward to having you on the, or having you join us again next week on another edition of the Charlotte Angel Connection.
William Bissett is an investment advisor representative with Sechrest Blakey & Associates, a registered investment advisor. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Sechrest Blakey & Associates. The topics discussed and opinions given are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. Sechrest Blakey & Associates does not offer legal or tax advice. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding your individual circumstance. Investments described herein may be speculative and may involve a substantial risk of loss. Interests may be offered only to persons who qualify as accredited investors under the Securities Act and a qualified purchaser as defined in Section 2A, Paragraph 51, Line A, under the Company Act, or an eligible employee of the management company. There generally is no public market for the interests. Prospective investors should particularly note that many factors affect performance, including changes in market conditions and interest rates, and other economic, political, or financial developments. Past performance is not and should not be construed as indicative of future results.